Part 1 of 9 from set number 3014, The Great Magicians, a BC Recordings copyrighted presentation by Stefan Heller entitled Myths of the Magical Enlightenment, Count Cagliostro and the Count de Saint Germain.
Within the context of this talk, we will be really concerned with two mythic archetypes, as Jung would have called them, one being that of the adept, and the other being of the enlightenment. By enlightenment, we mean here a specific historical phenomenon on this occasion, the movement of the enlightenment in the 18th century and proceeding into the 19th century, and the connection of these two. And we will illustrate this by way of the two great adeptic mystery figures of that period, namely the Comte Saint-Germain and Count Cagliostro. Now first, let's take a little look at the archetypal image or the mythic figure of the adept, which is definitely one that applies to these two people. Among the archetypal images, we might say, which play a particularly important role in the alternative reality tradition, really in any age, but which certainly also was present to a marked degree in the Enlightenment era, is that of the adept. It reappearing and re-emerging with never-failing frequency throughout history, we encounter a mysterious and haunting image. Also, I think, a very enticing and romantic image, which wears many masks, but seems to be one instead of many. And this is the image of the adept. Now, the word adept derives from the Latin ad apisci, which means to pursue, from whence is derived the noun adeptus, he who has obtained or successfully pursued something. So the term adept has been principally utilized, I would say, openly at least in alchemy, where the successful alchemist who has accomplished a great work was referred to as an adept, but it did not remain confined to that particular mysterious discipline, but came to also be applied in other kindred fields of endeavor. So what we are concerned with here is obviously not just the word or the term adept, but rather an entire sort of mythic image, which since the days of the alchemists certainly and the hermeticists has often been associated with the term adept. Now, what or who then is this this mythic figure of the adept? For our purposes, I would like to say that the adept is a figure who defies three limiting dimensions which confine ordinary mortals. Three of the no doubt numerous mental and psychological bars that lock us in, that are in our cage prior to having obtained liberty. Three of these are space, time, that's fairly easy up to that point, and, believe it or not, rationality or reason, especially in its less open forms as rationalism. And we might say then that the adept is one who has overcome the limitations of space, the limitations of time, and last but not least, the limitations of reason, or ordinary rationality, or the confinement of the mind within a consensus reality as we tend to know it. So let's look at these in sequence. The adept always defies or has conquered, in a sense, space. Now, I don't mean here now that the the adept is a sort of a one man or one woman NASA that, you know, flies off or who flies off into space. That's not the kind of space we are talking about here. But let's say clear when we look back to the earliest and most archaic manifestations of this mythic figure, where we encounter the shaman, we find that the shaman is a person, for the most part, who wanders. One of his characteristics is that he has no fixed locale. Also, often such figures of wizardry, shamanic figures, fly in the air, change into birds, into bats. Now, if you are familiar with some of the more recent mythos, you may remember a gentleman named Castañeda, whose books were very popular a while ago, and these early books, I think, are really terrific books, who used to change into a bird, a blackbird. Mm-hmm. Then, of course, we all know about Dracula, who changes into a bat, but that's a more specialized nature and kind of pertains to my home country, which is very close to Transylvania. So if you kind of feel at times that my remarks are verge on the batty, well, then you know why, you see. So the lack of confinement of the adeptic figure to space is that there is that really preternatural mobility of such a person. And we find all sorts of manifestations of that, you know. We, from India through Russia and through the Middle East, we find wandering holy men. What in Russian is called a starets, which literally means old fellow. Perpetual pilgrims, and we have the same thing, of course, in India. Then magicians. In Japan, there is a charming figure in the Japanese culture that is called a Yamabushi. Yama means mountain, like Fuji, Yama, you know, Mount Fuji. And a Yamabushi is someone who goes on the mountain, who lies down on the mountain. And the Yamabushis also are, let's say, religious magical figures, usually of the Buddhist tradition, who go up on the mountains and live there, meditate there. Mm. You go up on a high mountain, especially in Japan, you're going to be pretty cold, so I don't envy them in that respect. In any event, everywhere we look, we find in some form, in some manifestation, the archetypal figure of the wise and holy wanderer, Elijah of biblical lore, who is a very ancient archetypal figure of that sort. Why? Because according to the Old Testament, he is the person who never died. He flew away in a chariot. That's why he can come back anytime. That's why a chair in the Jewish tradition is laid for him at the Passover meal, and in places and in days when maybe there was less criminality, street crime, the door would be left open for him that evening so he could come in. Who, of course, then also received an archetypal, let's say, office in alchemy, where he was called Elias Artista. Elias, of course, is just a Greek form of Elijah. And Elijah the artist, meaning the Elijah the master of the alchemical art, very, very important figure. So we can see that one of the characteristics, wherever we look, of this kind of an adeptic figure is the overcoming, or at least the partial overcoming, of the limitations of space. You may have wondered why such mysterious figures now or earlier, I certainly have known a couple, you know, very often don't really have a discernible place of origin, at least not one that they own up to. Or if they say, well, you know, I was born in particular state of Australia, you go there and look for them, you know, nobody knows about them. And that's not because they are prevaricators, which they might be at times anyway, but it is because it pertains to the sort of the particular mythos that such a person doesn't have a definite origin, definite place of origin. They appear, and then very often, as we will see with the great adeptic figures of the 18th century, they also, let's say, the circumstances and the very possibility of their death is in question. They usually didn't die when people say they have died or where they have died. So this is the mysterious origins and mysterious endings. The alpha is in mystery, the omega is in mystery. So that's a very important issue right there. And then, of course, the adept is also someone who defies or conquers time. This is, of course, where the issue of immortality, which certainly was ascribed, for instance, to the Comte de Saint-Germain in a big way, and also to others, comes into play. The shamanic adeptic figures frequently appear to be ageless and deathless. I remember one particular person of that sort who I met him at one particular time, looked pretty old and frail, you know. You sort of felt like you wanted to take care of him. I met him 10 years later, and he was spry and young like you wouldn't believe. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Why? I don't know. How? I don't know. But, you know, this is kind of part of that mythos. And I don't mean to say that this particular individual had discovered the fountain of youth or something, but it was something of that sort, you know, was there, mysterious thing. This also has a good deal to do with, say, the Greek concept of apotheosis, which literally means deification. And you know, the Greeks, the ancient Greeks believed that there were mortals, such as ourselves. Then there were heroes who, and this doesn't mean necessarily hero on the battlefield or some spiritual heroes who stand out from the rest of humanity. And then the demigods and the gods. Goddesses, of course, too. So that there is a progression from the human to the gods. And what was one of the chief characteristics of the gods in ancient Greece? Immortals. The immortals. We were the mortals, they are the immortals. So that there was part of the picture of reality of the ancient Greeks was that one can progress from mortal selfhood to immortal, to an immortal status of divinity. The great sages of ancient China are called all the immortals, the 9 immortals. You have probably seen them. They're very frequently represented in art. You know, there's 9 old fellows who are usually sitting in a boat. And as Manly Hall used to say, they are total individuals. Each one is completely involved with what he's doing. The one is fishing, and the other one is reading a book, and the other one is looking up at the sky, and the third one is petting a bird, you know, they're all doing their thing, as maybe they're following their bliss, Joseph Campbell would say. The 9 immortals, you know, it's an old Taoist, Chinese idea. And so on and so forth. This, the conquest of time, is a very, very important issue. And of course, in connection with that, we have that always greatly sought after, but controversial commodity, prophecy. Prophecy in the sense of foretelling the future. As the late Hollywood prophet Criswell, whom I am still remember because I am so extremely old myself, you know, conquering time bit by bit. I don't know how long, but still. So I remember Criswell, who used to say that we are all interested in the future because that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And then he would go on to predict. Was quite a fellow. So the transgressivity from present into future, sometimes into past, but curiously enough, most people always want the future, not the past. Although sometimes I think the past, some period, some elements of the past may have been a heck of a lot more interesting than the future, you know. Nevertheless, you know, all of this has to do with the overcoming of time. Melchizedek, who is certainly a great adeptic figure of the Old Testament, even though not an awful lot is said about him, you know, is referred to as without a father and without a mother, without beginning or end of days. Somebody who travels back and forth on the time track, more or less, at will. And then, of course, the most controversial of all of these is probably the issue of the adept defying or conquering ordinary reason. Now, we need to keep in mind that it is not really part of the picture that the esoteric tradition or the alternative reality tradition advocates irrationality. No. In fact, the ancients who, by which I mean coming from Greco-Roman, Egyptian, Persian antiquity, has still had a more detailed, more accurate view of reason than we acquired later on. Why? Because they at least spoke of two kinds of thinking faculty. One which came to be known in Latin as ratio, from where we derive reason from. The other one was in Latin is called intellectus, and there are of course Greek and other equivalents of those terms. And so the reason or the sort of lower mind is what we are talking about here as being overcome by the adeptic figure. In other words, for most people, the consensus reality and the laws of reason within it, of causation and, logic and so forth, really keep the mind captive. They don't allow it to go further, you know. It's a little bit like the old story, it's as old as the hills, which has to do with the farmer from some Midwestern place many years ago. It's kind of a 19th century story. He came to the big city and went to the zoo. There he saw a giraffe. And his comment upon observing the giraffe was, but there ain't no such animal. Why? Because it didn't seem reasonable to him that there should be an animal with such a terrifically long neck and all that sort of thing. And similarly, you know, we decide sort of what is reasonable, what is possible, and if we should encounter something that's contrary to that, we deny it. We deny it, you know. This really happened that, for instance, back in the days when the first ocean seafaring ships, still sailing ships, came to some places like the Terra del Fuego at the southern tip of the American continent. That's how Charles Darwin, you know, sailed around and went to Galapagos and saw the big turtles and all of that and decided upon evolution. And the natives there had never seen anything like that. So they didn't see. They literally didn't see the ships. To them, there was nothing there. But there are shamans who are used to seeing weird things, because that's what the shaman does. The shaman said, look, you know, there's something over there. It looks kind of like a big house. And they started sort of describing it. And then they saw it. They saw the ships finally. So the mind begins to admit a certain kind of reality when it thinks it's reasonable. So this whole business of reason and reasonableness and laws of reason locks us into a particular kind of reality. Now, there is nothing wrong with being reasonable. In fact, one wishes that there were more people who were that way in the world. I'm sure you know many people who you wish dearly they would be more reasonable, you know. So that's not the issue. But the point is, when one is confined to that and cannot see beyond it, then, of course, we are experiencing certain limitation. This is a kind of limitation that the adeptic figure manages to transcend. Just transcends it. because it develops the facility to move, just like it develops the facility not to be confined spatially, or is not time-bound, also develops the facility to move between various realms of reality, what in the Kabbalah would be called in Hebrew olams, which is a world. There are worlds, not just this one that we experience physically, but others. And when we develop the ability to move reasonably comfortably among these realms, then we are dealing with sort of this kind of adeptic figure. So this is an important issue, that it's a trajectory that goes throughout history. In every age you find some of these people. And probably many of them you don't find because they're quiet, and they're only known perhaps to people in their immediate surroundings, and they don't attain to any fame. But no matter how far back you go in history, you find some of these figures, and many of them, of course, then draw whole big stories and myths around them, like Merlin and others. So right now, I would say, we are coming maybe to a point of time where an increasing number of persons, and most of them of a rather creative and perceptive nature, are agreeing that there is not only one reality, and that the reality offered by everyday analytical reason and logic can be defied on the special circumstances by those who know how. And we might say that we are beginning to discover the reality of non-rational reality, or a reality which supersedes ordinary reason. And people who do that, usually, of course, always that depends on the circumstances, usually are quite capable of very rational thinking and behavior at the external level, you know. I have known a few very practical people when it comes to the external life, but they know that that's not the only life. They know that that's not the only reality, and they know how to function in others. So this is how really the adeptic individual conquers the limitations of ordinary reason. Now, as we just noted, such figures conforming to the adeptic archetype have appeared with some frequency throughout history. How did they get to their particular status? That is pretty much of an individual matter. But it is also true that as a rule, it was accepted by many, many of these unusual people that their transformation, as it is often called nowadays, their change into that kind of an adeptic status is of an initiatory character, which means that it doesn't happen all at once, but that there are definite stages or steps which the person undergoes. And that those who work with these situations then often get together in associations, in groups, where in the change of consciousness, the change of status of the person, who may be called the candidate, is documented and solemnized and amplified by an initiatory procedure. That's where the initiate comes from, because that person then begins, after his initiation, her initiation, to function in a different realm of reality in addition to the one which they knew already. This is the beginning of initiatory organizations, bodies, schools, such as the Mysteries of Antiquity, said Mysteries of Eleusis in Greece and many others, right down to modern times, which I mention only because it's germane to our purposes here, to organizations such as Freemasonry, which are initiatory bodies of people. Now, interestingly enough, the most fascinating adeptic figures or mystery figures which we can study are often found not in a historical period as you might expect, when people were very romantic, when people were very gullible, where people were superstitious. You know, Madame Blavatsky, who knew about these things, a very interesting 19th century female adeptic figure, defined superstition once as truth materialized. Truth materialized. I won't expound on it any further, but it's a fairly good definition. So, you know, not in those periods, but actually in periods of time, not like biblical times or classical antiquity or even, say, like the time of the Hermetic Renaissance, but in 18th century Europe, when the Age of Reason, as it came to be called, heralded by the French philosophe writers, because that's what they call themselves, a little bit different from the English word for philosophers, the encyclopedists and so forth, people like Voltaire and Rousseau and so forth, would have been expected to have produced a climate inhospitable to the appearance of adepts. But that was not the case. In fact, now I come to the second mythos combined with the first, which is germane to our purposes, really, and that is the mythos of the Enlightenment. This is a certain narrative of reality which started in the early 18th century, pretty much, and went in a big way through that century and into much of the 19th. By the 20th century, it had sort of played itself out to a major extent, although we all have remnants of it still among us. In fact, probably more so in a certain area in America, because the American Republic was started at the time of the Enlightenment. And all the early leaders of the American Republic, beginning with George Washington on down, certainly Dr. Franklin, and all the rest, practically, all the people who signed the Declaration of the Independence and so forth, were all, children of the Enlightenment. That was their narrative of reality. That was their mythos. I intend to say more about it at a later time, but let me just say this much, that the Enlightenment is egregiously misunderstood, so I feel, by just about everybody. Of course, that means that I am just about the only one who understands it, which is maybe a slightly egotistical position, but you come to your own conclusion about that. But let's say the Enlightenment was really a movement of culture which had as its objective enlightenment, light. It is not exactly the same kind of enlightenment, say, as the enlightenment of Buddha or of the Hindu sages, but more specifically a way of cutting through what they felt was the darkness, often called obscurantism, which just means, well, self-explanatory, it is obscured, that arose as the result of the medieval Christian church and its activities. Now, this really means that medieval Christianity functioned to a major extent on a kind of emotion, on the level of an emotionally charged belief, which was quite appropriate at a certain time, but I think the way it developed, it became a hindrance to clear thinking. And so people came along who called themselves philosophers, les philosophes, lovers of wisdom, as the Greeks would call them, and said, you know, we've got to cut across this. Our culture is not going to get anywhere when it is mired down by established religion. That was, of course, a big thing, which fervently clings to its own beliefs and will not admit any kind of insight into or a view beyond those beliefs. Because you have to remember that at that time, everywhere you look on the face of the earth, really, religion and government were very, very close together. You know, where was the first place where they tried to separate the two? Right here, United States of America. And you can, we are all, we are critical people, and one always criticizes what is closest. I understand that. That's why families fight so much. You know, what was it? Somebody said a rather good one the other day, that families exist so that you don't have to fight with strangers. you got some people to fight with right there. It's kind of a convenience that way. So obviously we are critical of where we live and of our own country and all of that, but certain things you cannot deny, one of them being that the United States of America was the first body of people, really, on the face of the earth at that time, who separated religion and government. And that is a very, very big and really very important step. Because, you know, the Inquisition and all of these nasty sort of establishments of religion couldn't have done a doggone thing if it didn't have access to the power of the state, you know. The Inquisition always said, and it, you know, we didn't execute anybody. We didn't burn people at the stake, the inquisitors. We just inquired, which is inquisition, you know. We inquired, and when we decided that these people were bad, we turned them over to the secular arm, as they called it, to the soldiers of the state. And they are the ones who did the burning, the chopping off of heads, and whatever the case may be. Incidentally, you know, there were some pockets early on, before really the United States system was established, who, for instance, persecuted witches, you know, about the Salem witch trials. In America, they didn't burn witches, by the way. They executed them by other means. They didn't burn them. Europe, they burned them. Here, they didn't. So that separation was a very important issue. And so the Enlightenment philosophers strove to push back the power of religion, which it exercised by way of its association with the state and otherwise, and which they felt really, you know, kept people from seeing more light. And I think that on the whole, that was a valid idea and a valid position. But now, how are they going to go about it? You know, let's say you're an Enlightenment philosopher in the early 1700s in France or in Germany or there. How would you go about that task? You know, it wouldn't be easy. One of the ways that they used, which was quite effective, was reason. They said, these dogmas that the religious people adhere to, these commandments that these people, have to adhere to, they're not reasonable. They don't make any sense. They don't follow a logical sequence. Of course, the religious people say, well, they are based on revelation. But by way of applying the test of reason, they were able to push the power of religion back and back and back. And they succeeded eventually rather well. Of course, you know, humans go to extremes. This is the problem. So here were the French Enlightenment philosophy, worshippers of reason. They even, in the certain period of the French Revolution, they even thought, oh, well, we're going to have a religion of reason. So they got some kind of a minor actress, starlet, what do you call them nowadays, and took her into Notre Dame Cathedral and set her down on the altar and worshipped her as the goddess of reason, well, at least the representative, you know. I'm sure she liked it. But then, in very short order, things got out of hand, and they started cutting off people's heads with the guillotine, and then all of these organs of reason, all these heads were rolling in the streets. So, you know, things got out of hand. Things were not very reasonable anymore. That's what happens. You have to watch these developments and these excesses. But the issue of reason was the weapon. But don't let anybody tell you, as indeed some history books and so will, that that's pretty much all there was to the Enlightenment. It's not true. That was a weapon of the movement of the Enlightenment, and an effective one at that. I don't mean the guillotine now, but the weapon of reason. But beyond that, the Enlightenment philosophers ultimately derived their worldview pretty much from Hermetic Gnostic ideas of the early centuries, which they adopted and adapted to their use. And so what did that mean? It meant that the ultimate divinity has implanted into the human its own seed of light. Humans are capable of enlightenment. And that goes beyond reason. So, you know, if sometimes when I used to teach school, and I would tell my students that Voltaire, for instance, you know, wasn't just a worshipper of reason, but he practiced alchemy. He studied magic. Whole big collection of his writings and his sayings exist, which is called The Substance, I think, of the esoteric thought of Voltaire. And you'd be amazed at the kind of sayings, the kind of statements that this great philosopher made, which are strictly really of a magical and mystical nature, albeit not according to the mystical terminology, let's say, of the Christian Church. So, you know, that was there too. And this, in turn, this worldview instructed people that in the human being there is a transcendental divine potential. If that potential is realized, the sky is the limit to the abilities of the human being. Because the divine resides in the human, that's not the only place where it resides, but it does. And this is definitely something that comes from the classical antiquity and so forth. So it was a very complete and ultimately a very magico-mystical worldview that was present in the Enlightenment era, in the philosophies of the Enlightenment. And this is, incidentally, the philosophical and the mythic structure upon which the United States of America was founded. Now, you know, people have sensitivities to different things, but I certainly, for myself, can testify that when I was for the first time in Washington, D.C., and when I walked up to the Washington Monument, which is on obelisk in the Egyptian style, you know, and then, you know, to the Jefferson Memorial and all of these, I felt that an incredibly sweet and beautiful philosophical, magical, mystical atmosphere of the Enlightenment. Just like that obelisk points to the sky. This is the aspiration of the Enlightenment philosophy, that if you realize the spiritual potential within yourself, you know, you can go and the sky is the limit. And in fact, not even the sky is the limit. There is no limit. It's very, very important to keep those things in mind. Now, again, that may just be my personal orientation, but when I came to the Lincoln Memorial, I didn't feel that. It's a different period, different problems, it's not the same. But where we have Washington, where we have Jefferson, these are the pure representatives of the glory of the Enlightenment era. And we still live spiritually in many ways in this country still off those foundations. They are very, very important. There are problems with them too, but that's, as one might say, is the subject of another lecture. Okay? In any event, so you can see that with that kind of a philosophical view, which is one way one might characterize it is that it's a spiritual humanism. You know, people nowadays, they're humanists, they usually just don't have the, pardon the expression, they don't have the guts to admit that they are atheists. And then, of course, there is also an agnostic. That's another euphemism for an atheist. But a spiritual humanism, the boundless and wonderful human potential, which has to be encouraged, has to be coaxed to develop in the human being. But when it is, then wonderful things can happen. This was the view of the Enlightenment. You can see how that dovetails also with the issue of the adept. Because the adept is the example. The adept is the one who has become adept at what all the rest of us still need to do. And so there arose certain very amazing adeptic figures in that time, and two of the greatest were the Comte de Saint-Germain and Count Cagliostro. And you know, I'll tell you a few things about these. Now, as always, the origins of these figures are in doubt. First, a little about Saint-Germain, who incidentally, please, if at all possible, don't pronounce him Saint-Germain. Because first of all, he wasn't a saint, and moreover, that name would not be germane to what he really was, right? Saint-Germain is much better. Actually, if you want to be Italian about it, then say the San Germano, because he, in fact, stated at one point that the title of Count, his title was an Italian title, Conte di San Germano, and then they used the French form for it because it was in French so much. In any event, his known story is fairly easily and quickly told because so little is known. He surfaced for the first time apparently around 1740, so right about halfway in the century, in Germany, where he was befriended by an important Frenchman who happened to be there at that time, Marshal de Belle-Isle, and he was invited to France. And so between about 1750 and 1760, he enjoyed a period of great celebrity and popularity at the court at that time of Louis the 15th. But in 1760, he was compelled to leave France because there were machinations, jealousies going out against him. And eventually he came back again, and he had entry to practically all the important places in Europe, was known everywhere, and he was a man of magic and mystery. Voltaire himself described Saint-Germain as a man, this is a direct quotation, as a man who knows everything and who never dies. And I don't think he was joking. He was also a man whose origin was unknown and who disappeared without a trace, and who during his known career has performed spectacular healings, claimed superhuman age, made astonishing prophecies which proved true, played like a true virtuoso on the violin, painted very beautifully in oils, performed on the clavichord, charmed all the ladies, including Madame de Pompadour, who was of course the king's mistress, and later Queen Marie Antoinette in the next court. And he earned the respect and even the admiration of many crowned heads, including numerous German princes, Italian rulers, the great Tsarina Catherine the Great of Russia, and two kings of France. The worst anyone could more or less, with possible justification, say about him was that he was a dreadful liar, because the events that he alluded to, that he participated in, were way, way back in history, when one would think that he couldn't have been physically alive. He quite matter-of-factly stated that he was present at various historical events at the time of the pharaohs, through the events of the life of Jesus, the great battles of European history, and so forth. He also made personally, in personal conversations, various predictions, some of them very dire, about what would happen to different people, including King Louis XVI and various people, what would happen to them during the French Revolution, which of course was coming only a few decades away. And all of them proved to be true. I have lovely stories about them in some of these books, but I don't think I will have the time to read those this evening. And he is supposed to have died about 1784 while living on the estate of his patron and friend, the Landgrave of Charles of Hesse Castle, which is in Germany, who supposedly had him buried very, very quickly. And it was, and this widely believed, that the Landgrave was in fact party to a plot to lead people to believe that the Comte de Saint-Germain died, while he had simply gone away, never to reappear officially again. So we have this amazing adeptic figure here who, shall we say, sort of stirred up the spirits and the romantic projections and fantasies of many, many people. Now, was the Comte de Saint-Germain a Freemason? It would seem so. His connections with the Masonic initiatory order were not as openly professed and as much talked about as with the other gentlemen whom I am going to come to, but nevertheless they were there. And I can sort of testify to a little aspect of it myself in the city of Vienna, which of course, you know, for a long, long time was the seat of the Habsburg emperors, Holy Roman emperors for a long time, and then beginning with the early 19th century emperors of Austria, who were of course also kings of Hungary, which is my country. And there in the city are many beautiful, impressive buildings, which are, even though they are in the German-speaking land, are described by the French name of palais, which really means a palace. And these were, you might say, the townhouses, big, beautiful things, of the various famous noble families who lived part of the year on their estates in the country, but for various government functions and so would come to the city. Now, I was in one of these, which is the Palais Auersperg. It belongs to an old Austrian family, whom some members of whom I knew, the Princes Auersperg. And I was just a young fellow passing through Vienna, dodging the Russians. And, you know, this is 1940s. And the gentleman who owned the place at that time, the Prince Auersperg, showed me the house. We went to room to room. And like most of these big, beautiful old places, it had what appeared to be a ballroom, great big place. And the ballroom had some unusual features, like it had an elevated dais on one side, and then on other one, on the other side, and the other one, see, this and that. And I said, see, what are those features? They don't seem to belong to a ballroom. And he smiled and looked at me, because this is where a Masonic lodge used to be. This is where my ancestors held the Masonic meetings. Oh, I said, well, that's interesting. Oh, yes, he says, in those days, almost everybody who was anybody belonged to Masonry. And then he pointed to a very beautiful old sort of 18th century chair, a beautifully upholstered, fancy chair. And he said, you know, this is the chair in which the Comte de Saint-Germain sat when he presided over the Masonic meeting in this room. I said, oh. Yeah, he says, this is the tradition in our family. This is what I was told by my father, and he was told by his father, and so forth. I said, that's definitely interesting. So there was definitely a connection, let us say, between this particular adeptic figure and the at that time often very mystically and magically oriented Masonic order. Now, lest you thought that we would never get around to the other important person, a man who lived pretty much around the same time, you know, maybe a little bit later, and really there are tremendous parallels between their personalities and between their stories, although they are two distinct historical figures, and this was Count Alessandro Cagliostro, who lived between about 1730. There is a little doubt about his birthday, either 1743 or 1749 and 1795, so right up into the French Revolution. It was generally believed for a long time that he was born in Sicily and that his original name was Giuseppe Balsamo, of a originally Jewish family, that he took the name and the title of his godmother, who belonged to lesser Sicilian nobility, and that is how he became Count Cagliostro. However, there are some very reputable historians who feel that that is not how it was, that there really is no, there are no reputable data about the early part of his life. It is particularly a historian, very fine writer, whom I'm going to quote a little bit later on, by the name of Trowbridge, who was really the first one who wrote a very insightful and very sympathetic biography of Cagliostro, and who denied these tales of origin. He says they are not really right. Manly Palmer Hall, incidentally, was a great admirer of Cagliostro, said that Trowbridge was just about the only reliable authority on the life of Cagliostro. Well, anyway, when he was about 23 years of age, he was made a Knight of Malta, and the Knights were still on the island of Malta at that time, you know, very important, distinguished body of men, by a grandmaster who himself sort of had the reputation of an esoteric student, an occultist, and an alchemist. And Cagliostro's life also was filled with adventure, much misunderstanding, and ultimately appears to have ended in tragedy. He traveled and lived in many countries, including England, France, Prussia, and the Middle East. At the height of his fame, he was admired and lionized by the highest circles of society in France, Italy, England, and Germany. Apparently received his Masonic initiations in England, and then organized Masonic lodges all over Europe. And he was sort of the archetype of the adept and the mystery man in the eyes of all who were interested in such matters. Now, you need to remember one rather self-evident fact, but it needs to be mentioned anyway, that if you come to an 18th century European scene, it stands to reason that if anyone had as his objective to influence the culture in some direction, to bring some keynote into the culture, such a person would have proceeded through the royal courts and the nobility. Why? Because these were the normative people in society. After all, when at the time of the French Revolution, in the beginning, when the National Assembly, Assemblée Nationale, was convened, it consisted of the three orders of the society, the nobility, the clergy, and the bourgeoisie, as it is called, which would be the, you know, sort of the middle class, the businessmen and so forth. That's why always the joke was made later on, these were the three estates, as they were called, that the fourth estates were the journalists. who now would be called the media, you know, the fourth estate, and needless to say, the most troublesome of the lot. But, you know, if you were to spread ideas and orientation toward life and so to society, that is where you would start. And that is certainly what Cagliostro did also. But ill luck followed his footsteps. At the height of his fame in 1785, at the court of Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette, he was falsely accused of complicity in a particular kind of hoax that was going on at that time, which was called the necklace affair. Now, I'm not going to outline what that was, but it was a plot whereby particularly the queen was supposed to be made look bad. And somebody impersonated the queen, and then somebody wanted favors, brought this very, very valuable necklace and presented to who he thought was Queen Marie Antoinette, but it was really an actress who was hired for that purpose. And so it became a big scandal, you know. Politics was full of scandals in those days as it is nowadays. In any event, Cagliostro had nothing to do with it, but he was imprisoned, and after his release he fled first to London, where he published a letter to the French people in 1786, and then from there to, most unfortunately, he proceeded to Rome, where he was arrested by the church authorities. You have to remember that the entire city of Rome and some more land in those days was run by the Pope. The Pope wasn't just in Vatican City. The papal state was much larger than that. And they had their own police force, all that sort of thing. So he was arrested on the orders from Pope Pius VI. He was tried by the Inquisition for heresy and sedition, was condemned to death and sentenced to death, but eventually the death sentence was commuted, and it is generally believed that he died in the prison of St. Leo near Urbino, that he died a pretty miserable death. His wife, who was active with him in many of these activities, was also arrested, and she was also condemned to death, but sentence commuted, and she was confined in a nunnery, no doubt probably bossed around by a bunch of nasty hatchet-faced nuns, the kind that have made the lives of so many girls in America miserable when they attended their schools. You know that. I hear these stories always. I don't know, all the nuns whom I met, particularly in Europe, were pretty nice. But in any event, and she presumably died there. However, the story, as always, as I mentioned before, you know, the adeptic figure, the beginning and the end are always in doubt. So I'll give you, in this one, because this is really quite interesting, quite beautifully done, from Troubridge's biography of Cagliostro. This is the last definite trace of Cagliostro, he says at the end of the books. On the 6th of October 1795, the Moniteur, the paper of the time, states, "It is reported in Rome that the famous Cagliostro is dead. But when he died or how is absolutely unknown," says our author. "That his end was tragic," says one of the writers, "one can well suppose, and his jailers, to make sure that he should not escape, may have put him out of his misery." The Moniteur speaks of the probability of such an end as being a topic of conversation in Rome. "In any case, it seems impossible to believe that he could long have survived so terrible a doom, which, whatever his offense, was utterly disgraceful to the government that pronounced it." This mysterious end, so in keeping with Cagliostro's mysterious origin and personality, appeals to the imagination. Nothing excites curiosity like a mystery. Since his death, there have been as many attempts to lift the veil in which his end is shrouded as were made in his lifetime to discover the secret of his birth. Of these specimens, The Theosophist Madame Blavatsky is the most interesting, perhaps also the most unlikely, and the most popular among the believers in supernatural and occult matters, who often have allowed their imaginations to run riot on Cagliostro generally. According to the to Madame Blavatsky, whom he here calls the High Priestess of the Theosophists, Cagliostro escaped from the prison of San Leo, and long after his supposed death, in 1795, was met by various people in Russia, even residing for some time in the house of Madame Blavatsky's father, where, in the midst of winter, he produced by magical power a plate full of fresh strawberries for a sick person who was craving it. Had Cagliostro survived his terrible sufferings in San Leo till 1797, when the French invaded the Papal States, he certainly would have been set at liberty, because by then the French had undergone the revolution, Napoleon was coming, you know. San Leo, that's the prison to which the Pope's troops had retired, was then taken by the famous Polish Legion under General Dombrowski. The first thing the officers did on entering the fortress was to inquire anxiously if Cagliostro, whom they regarded as a martyr in the cause of freedom, was living. They sought to rescue him, says a contemporary writer, Figuier, and perhaps even to give him an ovation similar to that which he had received in Paris after his acquittal by the French Parliament. But they arrived too late. Cagliostro, they were told, had just died. According to another version, they demanded to be shown his grave, and having opened it, filled the skull with wine, which they drank to the honor of the revolution. Well, you know, that's kind of like maybe some of the Gothic young people would do nowadays, or something of that sort, you know. People had a commendable interest in macabre romanticism in those days, even as to some degree they still do today. The fate of the inoffensive Countess Cagliostro was quite as mysterious, though less cruel perhaps than her husband's. The Inquisition sentenced her too to imprisonment for life. She was confined in the convent of St. Apollonia, a penitentiary for women in Rome, where it was rumored that she had died in 1794. Once again, we don't really know about the end. But this writer, Trowbridge, is really one of the best in the field. Manly P. Hall wrote about Trowbridge that he is the only prominent champion of the much maligned count. All right, in addition to all this, what did Cagliostro do? Well, unlike Saint-Germain, let's say, whose Masonic connections are apparently more muted, he definitely founded lodges all over Europe of a Masonic jurisdiction which came to be called the Egyptian Rite. There are some documents available from that time, two documents which were, it's some reasonable evidence, I think, have been written by Cagliostro himself. They are Cagliostro's Confessions, which are very, very romantic, and which describe, even though I don't take them literally, I think that this is valuable material. They describe his origins as a child and his first instruction as having occurred in the Middle East, in Persia, and in some North African cities. But about the Egyptian rite of Freemasonry, in his treatise, the Arcana Arcanorum, it emerges that the Egyptian rite seemed to have been distinguished by three characteristics which one would not normally find in Masonic lodges. First, that the work of the order included a theurgical system of invocational magic. namely angel magic, which would invoke both the, what in ceremonial magic is often called the holy guardian angel, or a plurality of angels. In this respect, I think we find a close similarity between the Masonic work of Cagliostro and the original founder of the Martinist tradition, Martinez de Pasquali, whose order of the Elu Kohen, the chosen priest, chosen Kohens, is all filled with angel magic. Secondly, it appears that it was also a work that included laboratory work in alchemy as a part of the curriculum. And thirdly, something that was described as inner alchemy, and as far as one can tell, it seemed to have included yoga-like techniques. Incidentally, there is evidence indicating that in some fashion the Egyptian rite of Cagliostro admitted women, which would have been very, very unusual for that period, and that his wife was sort of the head of the feminine side of the work. It's quite possible. It has also been said by researchers in the field, and this is only of technical interest perhaps to some of us, but to those of us who are interested in these things, it's pretty important, that the cipher manuscript upon which the work of the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn in the latter part of the 19th century was based shows remarkable similarities with the Arcana Arcanorum of Cagliostro. So how that exactly worked, we don't know, although the German order of the Gold Cross and the Rose, the German Rosicrucian order, seems to have been involved. Also, it appears that Cagliostro was, in his youth, tutored by a Sicilian prince, Prince Raimundo di Sangro di San Severo, who died in 1771, who appears to have been both his mentor and his Masonic initiator. Manly P. Hall, in his wonderful book, now rather rare, called The Phoenix, writes as follows, and he has a lot of wonderful things to say about Cagliostro, but this I think is very useful. The real crux of the matter was the Count's attitude toward the traditional institutions of his time. He believed in magic. He claimed and demonstrated supernatural powers. He conjured spirits, predicted future events, and claimed to have medicines, talismanic and alchemical, by which he performed extraordinary cures without remuneration. So there is no doubt about it that we had here a very creative individual with great spiritual insight and power, who along with Saint-Germain really contributed to the rise of the esoteric tradition in the era of the Enlightenment, who influenced a lot of people, and the influence of these individuals really continues for a long time. So what we need then to keep in mind is that the mythos of the Enlightenment, which has such great influence upon the American Republic and its early founders, combined sort of with the, let's say, the spiritual background and the spiritual overtones of Freemasonry, that these developments were facilitated and initiated by some highly unusual people who could indeed, I think, with a little stretch of the imagination, be called, let's say, the spiritual powers that were behind the political developments of the time. And this, I think, is of some significance, especially for us here in America, because these spiritual currents still exist. And no doubt, with some modifications that are introduced by the change of times. They are still of, I think, of much influence and possibly hold much promise for the future. So that I think people living in the United States whose philosophical and psycho-spiritual background points to these mysteries and was greatly influenced by people such as the two figures, adeptic figures we just spoke about. Subsequently, of course, also by, when we come to the 19th century, as we know, by people like Eliphas Levi, also from France, through the great Masonic leader and authority, Albert Pike, in this country. So that you might say that, you know, the myth continues. The esoteric tradition and its workings in America are not a matter of a new age, but they are the matter of something that has always been here and that always has been very important. And as the new age sort of turns into old hat, the perennial and the timeless character of these traditions, as also embodied by such magnificent romantic figures, continues. And maybe, as indeed I hope to discuss on other occasions, maybe the time is ripe for us in today's United States, whether we have connections with, I think, one of the most creative initiatory orders of all times, the Masonic Order or not, wherever we may be, I think it may be useful for us to begin to reflect in an informed and insightful fashion on the spiritual roots of our country. You give some thought to the fact that unlike perhaps other political units in the world, that this country and this republic was founded by people who knew something. They knew something about matters of the spirit. They knew something about the esoteric tradition. Sometimes, like Cagliostro and people like that, they were actually, practical magicians and mystics who communed with some of these deeper powers, but that all of that they utilized and they channeled into the philosophy and the organizing of the American Republic. And so for that, there is something really good, really something very valuable, something of a great spiritual treasure at the foundation, in the foundation stone, so to say, metaphorically speaking, of the American Republic. And that maybe we should pay some attention to that. Maybe we should both within ourselves in a meditative fashion and perhaps by some study, we should come closer to it. And maybe if we did that, then the difficulties and the vagaries of political life in this country would take a different turn. Because where there is no vision, the people perish. And the practical exigencies of politics do not qualify as such a vision. Vision, real vision, must include the vision of things beyond this physical world. Real vision must include contact with those powers and those sources of inspiration and of grace and indeed of enlightenment, which have always been in the world, but which we need to rediscover from time to time again and revivify their presence within ourselves. Maybe that is a very important project that we individually and perhaps our people in good time collectively might address themselves to. And if that could be done, then perhaps the future of this nation might take a turn that would be in the direction that its founders have envisioned, and that was inspired and inspirited and blessed, so I feel, on the basis of much very clear evidence, thus inspired and blessed by sources of inspiration and by powers that are beyond this world, but upon whom this world depends for its survival, and we depend for our enlightenment. So I hope that this has been a little bit of a source of inspiration to you, that it may have aroused your interest along certain avenues that otherwise might not have been the case. And if that is so, then indeed I'm very happy to have been able to present that to you, and looking forward to more later on. So I thank you very much for your time.
Catalog NMD supplied by BC Recordings. Catalog number 301401. For more information about available lecture titles and for many other resources, visit gnosis.org. That's GNOSIS.org.